Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
In 1997, writer Dinty W. Moore launched a literary journal on a then novel platform, the World Wide Web. The journal, which he called Brevity, created a forum for works of nonfiction under 750 words in length. Since its inaugural issue, Brevity has produced hundreds of pieces that thrive on the concision and compression demanded of this genre, one that has its roots in figures such as Heraclitus, Seneca, Montaigne, and today includes some of the most interesting writers working in nonfiction. On Brevity's blog, and in its book reviews and essays on craft, are discussions and debates about the nature of what, by turns, has been called the micro-essay, flash nonfiction, or, in William Makepeace Thackeray's term, an essekin. Whatever it's called, it's a vibrant and fascinating genre, as Moore himself has shown in his own essays on George Plimpton, Frida Kahlo, and the haunting faces of old men on the streets of Edinburgh. Moore has brought this expertise and excitement to a new anthology, The Rose Metal Press Guide to Flash Nonfiction, Advice and Essential Exercises from Respected Writers, Editors, and Teachers. It includes contributions by 26 writers who each discuss some element of craft, point of view, for example, or the use of research, along with an exercise for practicing this element and an example of an essay that demonstrates it. And here, by way of full disclosure, I should say that I'm one of the 26 contributors. The result is both an introduction and exploration of a genre that Moore compares to a forest fire, where, as readers, we're like smoke jumpers, one of those brave firefighters who jump out of planes and land 30 yards from where the forest fire is burning.
Dinty Moore, welcome to the New Books Network.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
So you are the editor of the recently released Rose Metal Press Field Guide to Writing Flash Nonfiction, Advice and Essential Exercises from Respected Writers, Editors, and Teachers. And it's a goldmine of a book.
And if we repeat the title, we can take up the whole show.
I think it's quite possible.
I didn't realize how long the title was till you read it out loud to me. We'll call it the Rose Metal Press Guide to Flash Nonfiction.
That's so much shorter. There should be an acronym that could probably come out of it.
About RMP Field Guide.
Perfect. Perfect. Well, thank you for being on the show. And before we get to talking about the book, I was just wondering if we could go back a little bit and you could tell us a little bit about how you came to put this together. This is not your first time at the nonfiction Flash Nonfiction Rodeo.
Well, let's see. There's two ways of getting into this story. The first one is that Rose Metal Press has done a flash fiction guide similar to this one, but different authors, different essays, and a prose poetry guide. So I approached them about a third volume focusing on the flash essay or flash nonfiction. I, for the last 17, 18 years, have been editing an online magazine named Brevity, which publishes flash nonfiction, flash essays, all of them 750 words or less. So it is not my first time to the Flash Essay Rodeo. It's something I've been involved with for many years.
And I think that you're also a practitioner.
Uh, I have written some flash essays. I find them very challenging. People often assume that because I edit this magazine and spend so much time reading them and choosing them and publishing them, that I somehow have learned some secrets that make it easy for me. I find it a very challenging genre because there's very few words, and it takes an extreme amount of craft to create movement and create suspense and create an entire sort of atmosphere.
Is that
an essay this brief?
Is that challenge part of the attraction for you to editing?
Oh, definitely. I think for myself, for the authors, for the readers, there's been a steady growth in interest in the genre for as long as I've been involved, and certainly a growth of interest in the magazine that I edit, as more and more people write for it, more and more people read it, more and more people get talking about it.
And we'll make sure that listeners have a link to Brevity in the online introduction to this essay. And if you go back to that first issue that I think was published in 1998, it's just one little lone HTML page with a little bit of text up in the corner. And now when you go to Brevity, it's not just pieces of flash nonfiction, but it's also essays on craft and an ongoing blog and Twitter feed. And it's really become quite a vibrant scene for the creative nonfiction world.
Yeah, I hope it has. And that's been my goal sometime. I think when I was a kid, this was back when the dinosaurs roamed the planet. I think I always wanted to have my own newspaper. I didn't even know, you know, what that meant. But I'm talking about, I was 6 years old. I said, I'm going to have a newspaper. And I feel like I somehow have ended up there. It's my instead of a newspaper that services the city of Cleveland or the city of Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, I have a newspaper that services the international nonfiction world.
Well, turning to the book, what you're saying about wanting to be a newspaper person reminds me of Franklin and his autobiography, slipping little things that he'd written under his brother's door in the hopes that they would publish it. And the story that you tell about this genre, flash nonfiction, you include people like Franklin in the history of it, and you begin kind of trying to figure out where this genre might start to develop a name with William Makepeace Thackeray in 1868. There's suddenly this genre that emerges that he calls an essaykin.
Yeah, and I'm glad that name didn't stick. It's pretty goofy, but he talks about a party game where similar to I forget what the game is now called, but somebody tells a story and then somebody repeats it and then somebody repeats it. Though in this case, I think somebody tells a story and then people write it down after it's been told. And he calls these little things essaykins. And part of the fun is the accuracy or lack of accuracy of people's memories as they try to capture these stories, these true stories that people tell.
And so there you suddenly have a name, and the name seems as though it's changed as it moved forward from there. I think the first thing that Brevity calls it is a micro essay when you name it.
I think we called it concise nonfiction.
Okay.
The name, the legacy of very brief nonfiction literary essays is that there wasn't a name. The name changed constantly. The form changed constantly. I mean, part of it is part of it is the story of technology. We're talking about, you know, literature going as far back as perhaps the Greek orators, who were writing in some cases very brief orations, which were nonfiction. So we could start there if we want. I jokingly sometimes call the early cave paintings, nonfiction essays, the subject being, these are the animals we hunted this week. It's a game, but you can go back as far as you want. Probably not to the cave paintings. That might be a bit of a silly conceit, but certainly the work of Montaigne, the 16th century French writer who is credited with coining the term essay and really beginning the essay movement that exists today. Some of his pieces were very, very long, but some of his pieces fall into the 1,000 words or 750 words or less category that we're now calling the brief essay. This went forward through some of the British essayists who followed in Montaigne's shoes. Suddenly, we're into the newspaper era, and people are writing very brief. People like Twain are writing very brief essays in newspapers that are not necessarily journalistic so much as essayistic. And every time you dip into the pond, the form has changed a little bit, and nobody's quite gathered a name for it. The 1990s is when flash fiction became quite a phenomenon, both in Europe and in the United States. And the name flash fiction stuck to the very, very, very short fictional story. And only lately is the term flash essay or flash nonfiction gaining traction in the midst of all the other possible names or no names. It often wasn't named. It was like there's the essay or there's creative nonfiction, and sometimes it's short, sometimes it's long. I'm confusing myself with this answer. People have always been writing in this genre. The name probably isn't established yet, but perhaps the Rose Metal Press Field Guide to Writing Flash Nonfiction is the first step to normalizing a name that people will use and recognize.
Anything that rolls that easily off the tongue. Well, so it's clear from the guide and the contributions in the guide that people are much more interested in, and you are much more interested in what this thing is and how you make it than what it's called, that the name is kind of incidental to the importance of the art. And I think that the book serves a lot of purposes. And so on the one hand, you're basically creating a topography of a genre that hasn't really had a lot of attention devoted to it in the scholarly realm. And then on the other hand, you're very interested in how these things get made and making them. And that's, I think, the guide part of the title. Could you tell us a little bit about what this group of practitioners brings to the experience of the genre? You know, you didn't invite scholars to come in and
right.
And contribute.
Well, each of these pieces, and there's 26 of them, if my memory serves me, is written by a different author who begins their section of the book with a discussion, a craft discussion. Here's what I think that can be done in the brief essay. Here's how the brief essay works. Here's how voice functions in the brief essay. Here's whether digression is possible in the brief essay. Each of the authors starts there and then follows with a writing exercise or prompt, something that the reader of the book can do in their own writing to try to use some of what, or attempt some of, or discover or explore some of what was discussed in the craft essay. And then again, in the same section, that author follows up with an example of an exemplary essay, possibly an essay they wrote that they think illustrates the craft lessons that are being discussed, or in many cases, an essay somebody else wrote that the author found exemplary and thinks illustrates voice, craft, characterization, setting, all the various different elements that go into prose writing.
And to my mind, what you get is something like the equivalent of having a fascinating writing partner sitting across from you, because you get the discussion and then you get, let's try this thing out. And you have the whole time as a guiding example, this model that's sitting right there in front of you.
Well, thank you. I hope that's what happens. The people that ended up in the book are fascinating and intelligent people. So it is very stimulating to hear their ideas. They also don't agree all the time. I don't know that they flat out disagree, but everybody comes at it. You know, that's what art is all about. Everybody comes at it from their own little corner of the room, and everybody has their own nuanced approach. And I think that the discussion that, you know, when you read three of them at once or read four of them at once, or if you get, you know, a couple of them together and then try the prompts, sort of discussion that goes on between the authors and the person doing the reading, and certainly the person doing the reading, the reader, who's also writing in response to the book. There's a whole lot of sort of conversation and new territory being covered. And that, I hope the book functions that way.
Yes, I must confess that I experienced the book in probably the wrong way that you're supposed to experience it, which is I sat down, I read the introduction, then I read it beginning to end, not stopping, not doing the exercises because I was curious about what the various writers had to say about all these facets of the genre. And I did notice these tensions where, you know, you'll have someone talking about, you know, the use of objects as being crucial to flash nonfiction. And then later you'll have someone say, well, no, the really crucial thing is the movement, is the action, is the dramatic scene that's taking place as it's happening. And you think, wait, am I focusing on an object or am I focusing on a movement? And I think there what you get is the idea that what an anthology can do at its best is show just how varied and rich the production of art can be, and that one particular theory is only going to get at a facet of one kind of art making.
And my introduction attempt to offer my definition of what a flash essay is. And my definition is it's a metaphor for, you know, focus and fire and incendiary. You just head for the center of the fire as fast as you can. And that's the flash of the essay. And as I was shopping around for people to contribute to this book, Judith Kitchen, who's a wonderful writer and an anthologist herself, said she wanted to do a chapter on digression, which is kind of the opposite of that, you know, singular focus, moving as quickly as possible towards the fire at the center of your topic. You know, she says there's room for wandering around, just like there is in a larger essay. And when I read her contribution, I had to agree with her, which I guess put me in the unique position of disagreeing with myself. But that's why art is art. You can't pin it down. You can't dictate one definition. As soon as you have pinned it down and dictated one definition, you've probably killed it. So I think it's a tribute to the vibrancy and excitement of the genre that these people are willing to and able to toss the ball around and come up with different ideas, different approaches, different, you know, this is what you must do until you read somebody else's, you know, contribution, and that person will tell you, no, this is what you must do. As long as you're learning from these disagreements and not being confused by them, I think that's a healthy and useful conflict.
I completely agree.
Conflict isn't even the right word. Discussion.
Yes, it's. I don't know. To me, it feels so alive, and I think what I find the writers in here sort of embracing is the idea that the art will stand on itself. It will work or it will not, and then we'll kind of catch up to figure out what it's doing. But we're not so locked on, you know, genre definitions or something like that, that's going to get in the way of appreciating how a really great piece will work.
The book we're discussing is focused on flash nonfiction, the very, very brief essay. But, you know, to be honest, I don't know what I'm being. Let me mention this. The nonfiction genre generally, whether it's the very short or the medium or the long or the book length, is a very alive and dynamic place right now. I mean, after years and years and years of being sort of locked into certain journalistic rules or even, you know, memoir, autobiographical tropes and expectations, for the last 15 years at least, authors internationally have been sort of exploding the genre by trying, you know, so many different things, whether it's, you know, the hermit crab essay or other formal experiments or very strong language experiments in the lyric essay movement. Right now, I think the nonfiction genre is a really exciting one. And the very, very short one is certainly part of that discussion, I'm glad to say.
And so you have some very experimental pieces in this collection. Jenny Bouie's piece, on Beginnings.
Yes.
How would you even describe an animal like that to someone who might not be familiar with experimental or lyric nonfiction?
I would begin by talking about poetry. Poetry, in poetry, poetry can tell a story. Sometimes poetry doesn't tell a story, at least in a recognizable way. The lyric essay sometimes tells a story, sometimes tells a story, but not in a narratively recognizable way. Because the language itself, both the choice of words and the sound of those words, can get emphasized to the point that the language becomes the story, or the language becomes the center of the essay. Even further, sometimes, you know, the sound of the language. So, frankly, the lyric essay is perhaps the hardest for me to describe. You should feel free to jump in here and save the day if you can do a better job. But the nonfiction genre has the flexibility right now to go from something that just reads like a story on the page, and a wonderful story on the page, and it almost, you know, reads like fiction, except it's true, to something that has a little more experimentation with thought and meditation and digression, to something that frankly, to some people, they're not going to recognize it right away. They're going to say, what am I reading? And like poetry, you have to slow way down in reading a piece like Jenny Booley's piece, and start to take in the language, the syntax, the rhythm, you know, almost listen to it the way you would listen to a musical composition, not the way you would listen to the lyrics of a popular ballad, you know, that's telling a story.
Sure. Yeah, I think that, and some of her sentences do rise to the level of music. They're just beautiful. I tend to, when I encounter an essay like that, I often think of, I had a teacher once who talked about the non-semantic aspects of language, sound and rhythm and everything else that wasn't just content. But I also think that there's almost an invitation or a willingness to invite strangeness into the piece, which is one of the qualities of I think, innovative art, is that it allows itself to drift away from the very rules that had once defined it, to see what other truths can be discovered when you begin to go off net map into someplace new.
Yeah, I mean, if you're familiar with experimental theater or experimental dance, you know, there, again, strangeness is actually the perfect word. It's just all of a sudden the absurd or the bizarre or the contradictory non sequitur not only are allowed into the piece, but they often contain much of the energy of the piece.
And then you
experimental nonfiction, I guess, you know, it can go to the absurd, the bizarre, the contradictory non sequitur, and draw energy from it rather than simply getting confused.
I think that's true. They become, in the hands of artists, strategies for making meaning in what other contexts would just simply be nonsense or non-recognition. And so alongside a piece like Jenny Booley's, you have a piece that might surprise people who were expecting to read anything with an essay on it. There's one by Maggie McKnight that looks much more like a comic.
Well, it is. It's a graphic memoir, just like Alison Bechdel has done wonderful work with the book length graphic memoir, including her book Funhouse, which some of your listeners might be familiar with. Maggie McKnight. And others, but Maggie McKnight is represented in the book, using a graphic or illustrated memoir, and I think using it beautifully. The pictures tell part of the story, but the text within the pictures interacts with the images to tell the complete story, and it's one of my favorites because it's beautiful, but it also sort of pushes the way I think about what could be done in an essay.
So when you have something like that in front of you, and I agree with you, I think the simplicity of some of the illustrations allows for at least me as a reader to project a lot of meaning into them. And I think that the pieces are drawn to let you do that, to give you that kind of freedom to be an active reader working with the imagistic elements of the essay. How does it open up how you think about the essay as someone who's been, you know, thinking about the short form for the last 17 years? Now you've got a graphic essay, which is changing even the nature of the medium in which we talk about an essay.
Well, when you come down to the definition of the essay, and of course, again, it being an art form, there's many, many definitions floating around out there. But my definition is through language, the writer makes you think about the world you live in some way you hadn't thought about it before, makes you look at some common aspect of human nature or the world around us in a way you haven't looked at it before, raises questions and nuances or transforms those questions so that they're asked in a way you haven't heard them asked before. It's the opposite of the newspaper editorial. The literary essay doesn't tell you the answer. It gives you ways of looking at the questions. Well, you can do that in other ways than just the standard alphabet on a white page. I happen to know that you know this well because you, as a writer, experiment with this yourself. But people are now realizing that the documentary film can function as an essay. The brief experimental, almost lyric film can function as an essay. Text and image side by side, or layered one on top of the other, can function as an essay. I know that the theatrical monologue can function as the essay. I'm still pretty mired in the world of the essay on the page. It's what I teach, and it's what I think about, and it's what I publish primarily in my magazine. But lots and lots of people are starting to think about the essay as it comes off the page and other ways it can, other places it can go.
So we will include for listeners links to Dinty Moore's Google Maps essay, which takes place through the medium of Google Maps, as well as his video essays, just so that you can test his hypothesis, at least about himself. But you had said earlier that that you thought that this is a right time for creative nonfiction. And now you're talking about all these different media that seem to be playing a part in that ripeness. Why is the moment right in our literary culture right now in American letters for creative nonfiction? You know, is there something in the soil that's helping this grow, in your opinion?
You know, I don't know. I've heard many people smarter than me think about it and talk about it. I've heard some theories that sound good, but I don't absolutely buy into any one of them. One theory, and this is probably the closest to the truth, closest to what I think might be the truth, but I'm not going to claim it as the gospel truth by any means. I think that the role of fictional storytelling has been, not that the novel is dead, I'm not arguing that, but the role of fictional storytelling has so strongly been claimed by film, television, HBO miniseries, whatever you want to call that visual medium of film and video, that people are turning to the written word more for their nonfiction storytelling, to be stimulated in a nonfiction way. I don't know that, though there are, the documentary film has not gained nearly the popularity as the, you know, the fictional film, for lack of a better term. So somewhere in there, I mean, you can hear me pausing and halting because I don't even have a fully formed theory, but you know, people are hungry for stories. We're always hungry for stories. People want to understand the world they live in, and people are full of questions about the world they live in. I mean, always have been, but certainly still are. So they're turning to different places, and I think they're turning to their big old television screens for much of the storytelling that we call fiction these days. But they're still hungry to learn to read about other people's experiences in a relayed in a nonfiction manner. And then here I go halting and stopping again, because I don't know why that, you know, I don't know where that heads. So I have half of a theory. And then the listeners can fix the other half.
We'll invite them to send in comments. Well, one of the things that I think comes across to me so clearly with the editorial vision in Brevity is a love of stories and a love of complexity. In not minimizing the complexity of lived human experience. And so they become so rich. And by the time I finish, you know, a volume, a new issue, which might be 8 to 12 stories, I'm exhausted as though I've been in the wing of a museum, even though these pieces are very short. So maybe one way you could help enlighten people who might not be as familiar with the genre about what it does is, how would you distinguish it from genres that seem like they'd match it? I mean, blog posts can be about 700 words long. You mentioned newspaper editorials. They can be about 700 words long. I mean, that length is out there and around, even in the nonfiction sense. So what is it that's special that the flash form has to offer? What is it doing that gives that sense of richness?
Like art in general, literature in general, but again, in a very intensified form, these flash pieces examine very closely those difficult or heightened or utterly perplexing human experiences. So, I mean, there's a fair number of pieces that are about difficult subject matter, you know, childhood friends who end up becoming murderers. Or rapists, authors who themselves are victims of violence or sexual assault, difficult childhood experiences. Not all of them. It's not, you know, not, but you'll find a lot of blood on the page, a lot of heart on the page, a lot of honesty. There's no sort of 750 words of easy answers. You know, well, you know, I was faced with a challenge and I whistled a happy tune and everything turned out okay. There's some really, really rough honesty that comes to bear in these pieces. Even the ones that are not about, you know, what I just characterized as difficult human situations, even the one that are, that you might call a travel piece, the author goes to unexpected places and takes it to unexpected depths and challenges the reader to really see not the surface, but the many, many layers of experience. So perhaps I'll repeat that whether it's a travel piece, whether it's a piece about a somewhat pleasant, event in the author's life, or whether it's one of the pieces that looks at the tough things that happen to human beings, and tough things that human beings bring upon others and bring upon themselves. No matter what kind of a piece it is, we're always challenged to you know, see the surface and then just keep going and keep going, and we get pulled into the deeper and deeper layers of sorrow, or the deeper and deeper layers of regret, or the deeper and deeper layers of loneliness. And that can be invigorating, it can be exhilarating, and it can be exhausting.
Exhausting in the way that great art is exhausting. I think I feel like I'm asked to bring my whole being to these pieces in a way that when I'm skipping through something online, like somebody's blog, it doesn't ask that much of me, and in the end you can be exhausted because you're transformed.
Yeah, I mean, a blog post can actually be a brilliant and lovely flash essay, but most of the time they're providing information or observation. The pieces I'm looking for brevity, or the pieces that are being discussed in the flash nonfiction anthology, aren't just providing information, nor are they just providing observation. They're, again, trying to immerse the reader in emotion and experience, in that sort of deeply layered way that I keep referring to.
Just to give listeners an example, your description makes me think of Nicole Walker's marvelous essay, in which she alternates back and forth between a kind of meditation on eating meat and eating animal bones in particular, and taking her young child to get an MRI in the process of those two bodily moments, and it just moves forward in ways you'd never imagined these two things could be compared and sustained. And by the end, it's really quite shattering.
Yeah, I agree. It's a beautiful essay, and it's a beautiful example. It doesn't reduce vegetarianism or lack of vegetarianism to some simple choice or aphorism, and it doesn't reduce the utter fear you have when your child is ill to some simple choice or happy saying. It really kind of digs and digs and digs and takes these two experiences and puts them side by side to make you think about both of them. Think about both of them differently than you expected to think about them.
So we've been talking a little bit about, well, actually a lot and quite in depth about the art itself and kind of what we experience and what it looks like when it's finished on the page. The book is also deeply interested in how these things get made and artistic process. And I want to turn us a little bit and talk about what goes on behind the curtain before, you know, the reader gets to encounter what these writers have produced. And it's surprising some of the range of exercises, from treating the essay that you're working on like a letter and going off and reading it on the bus and seeing what you hear there as opposed to at your writing desk, to going out for a walk at dusk and writing there. So can you take us a little bit behind the scenes into the creation of these pieces and perhaps your interest in that or what you were trying to capture by putting the book together?
Well, the real answer to that is that, you know, the 26 different authors are represented in this book, and I think this is wonderful and exciting, would have 26 different answers to that question, because we all approach our writing somewhat differently. We all have a slightly different process. We all have slightly different tricks to get at the material. So I'm just going to say no. I'm kidding.
But you're right. It was a crappily asked question.
I can't sort of summarize it, but I can say that when you talk about these different techniques, taking an essay you're working on and putting it in the second person, taking an essay you're working on and inserting sections of reflection and thinking about, you know, the reflection and how it functions in the essay, taking a walk at dusk, all of these things, all of them are trying to get at, you know, I talked about how these essays, when they work the best, take you beyond the surface and you go deeper and deeper and deeper into an experience. Well, the writer has to do that first before it can happen for the reader. So I'll talk about my own process, which is that I write a first draft of something. And I look at it and I go, that is very dull and it is very much on the surface. And I've said some pretty obvious things. And frankly, if I showed that to, you know, intelligent readers now, they'd say, that's pretty predictable. That's my first draft. And that's why my first drafts don't get put into envelopes and mailed out to editors. You know, so my process is to write that first draft and then stare at it and say to myself, okay, you really have to dig deeper. There's more to this. You have to ask some tougher questions or examine some tougher details or aspects of whatever my topic is on that given day or that given week. So I write another draft and I try to get, and I might find one or two sentences in there that surprise me, that I say, oh, wait a minute, there's a little bit of risk taking there, or there's a little bit of surprise there. You know, so I pull those sentences out and say, okay, that's where I want to go. And so I start writing around those sentences. And, you know, it's a recursive, a repeated process. You know, and then I find something surprising, confounding, challenging in my third draft, and I take that and use it to form my fourth draft. And by the time I'm 10 or 11 drafts into working on a particular essay, I usually ended up someplace I didn't think I was headed. It's not really an essay that I would say is about what the essay was about in the first draft. And it's not really an essay that I could have planned to reach. It's an essay I sort of have to keep scratching and scratching and scratching at the surface to reach. So, I mean, that's my technique, but I think that reflects a lot of what you find in the book. People are saying, okay, you can only take it so far by saying, okay, I'm going to write this. I'm going to make it sound good. You have to find other ways that force you underneath that surface layer, that force you to surprise yourself. I mean, I'm not the first writer to say this or the first artist to say this, but you know, the moment at which you've surprised yourself is the moment at which your painting or your essay or your poem is really starting to come alive.
I think what I was trying to get at in my crappily asked question was that there's a lot of generosity in this book of writers sharing with the reader techniques that I think they actually use, which is different from someone, you know, there's lots of those, I think, less interesting guides out there that kind of click through things. And when I read them as a
practice, Use colorful nouns,
fill out your character star chart, you know, that sort of terrible thing or its equivalent. And so I wanted to get at some way of showcasing that part of the book, because I think it's a rewarding one. And so I want to ask you a question. I believed you because I your answer is true, and I know you work very hard on your essays. But if somebody who wasn't a writer had said, you know, I'm sure you revised Dinty, but really 10 or 11 times, is that just maybe a writer being a little bit hyperbolic? That sounds like a lot.
No. 10 or 11 times is really kind of undershooting. I write really horrible first drafts, and I write pretty rotten second drafts. And honest to goodness, if I think of the pieces that I've published in magazines, I've been over them 40 times. But that's not even just going over them with a comb and making my sentences prettier. You know, in those 40 revisions, about 5 of them involved throwing my hands up saying, this isn't working at all. And sort of ripping the seams back out of the garment and saying, okay, you know, here's the sleeves of the shirt. Here are the lapels of the shirt. Here are the buttons. Here's the front. Here's the back. You can tell I don't sew because I don't really have any more language than that. And I lay it all on the floor and start all over again and try to build a different shirt. It really is for me. And not all writers, but most of the writers, you know, 93.7% of the writers I talk to, it really is a process of putting together a draft or a third draft that you don't even like, and then ripping it apart, trying to find, well, what is worthwhile in there? What am I going to keep? And all artists talk about this, you know, and then, you know, there's that moment of self-loathing. It's like, this is so boring. And then you realize, wait a minute, there's a sentence, and that's an interesting sentence. And if I go back and just start with that sentence and see where it takes me. So no, I mean, I honestly cross my heart, probably do about 40 drafts, at least 5 of them severe rewrites, before any pieces I can call of my own, I can call finished.
And for you, what's the payoff when you finally see it? I mean, it almost sounds from that process that you'd have an animal that seems almost, I don't know, what's the word I'm looking for? Something like you've created something you couldn't have imagined. There's some sort of surprise. There's this thing standing in front of you.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. Before I get to that, I think I meet a lot of young, and by young, I mean they're they could be 70 years old. They're just starting to think about themselves as writers. I meet a lot of beginning young writers who hate revision, and I think they're discouraged by it because they get to their second or third draft and say, oh, it's kind of hard to look at because it doesn't live up to my expectations. I wanted to be a genius writer, and I look at my own stuff and it's kind of so-so. So I don't even want to read it again. So I'm going to stop revising it. I mean, I run into that a lot because I teach writing, as you know. But if you do it the way I'm talking about, if you really are, catch that fire of vision, it's an exciting, exciting process. It's really a lot of fun. It's like, it's like climbing a mountain. It's like cooking a meal, whatever it is you really enjoy doing, that takes effort and creativity. I mean, if you're willing to embrace the idea that your first, second, third, and fourth draft are just the barest beginning of finding out what's really important, interesting, and surprising about your subject matter, then it can be really, really exciting to do it when it's working. I have bad days where I just want to, eat pencils and punch myself in the side of the head. But on days that it's working, it's really exciting. And yeah, and then the payoff, as you predicted, is I learn things. I didn't know I thought that. I didn't know I knew that. I didn't know I remembered that. I didn't know that I thought about it that way. The subject matter is even richer than I'd imagined. The questions are even more perplexing. I'm not a person who's ever believed in easy answers. So I sort of enjoy arriving at those conclusions that, oh my goodness, this is, I didn't even know that I was going to come to that partial conclusion or raise that question, or that this part of my life and that part of my life both, reflect on this question that I'm asking. I love to discover new things, and that writing process I'm talking about allows me to discover things. The opposite of that being, oh, okay, I already know the answer, I'm going to write it down and then show it to people. That feels like a dull process to me.
You make it sound very exciting.
Yeah, and to be honest, yeah, thank you. I hope I do. But to be honest with your listeners, there are days that I'm just pushing sentences around on the page and saying, oh my goodness, this is not going anywhere. But I honestly believe that you have to sort of pay your duty to those days so that at the end of the week, those good days come where the sentences start jumping off your fingers and it's like, who wrote that? Oh, that's interesting. Neat.
Well, with that in mind, can you tell us what you're working on now?
I have a number of very experimental in form essays. I've done, you mentioned my Google Maps essay. I've done a series of this essays that are Facebook posts, essays that are written entirely on cocktail napkins, essays, photo essays. I'm working on an essay as crossword puzzle now. I'm trying to do an advice column essay, Ann Landers kind of thing. There's still nonfiction, still exploring, various questions that I have about the world I live in, but also experimenting. What can the essay look like on the page? So I think I might have a book's worth, I keep pulling things together and I'm writing some new material, an essay that replicates the Baltimore Catechism. I'm pulling all these together and I'm hoping that it's going to be a book, but goodness knows, I'm not even sure of that because it's hard. It's hard to get all this together.
Well, Dinty Moore, best of luck with the book, and thank you so much for agreeing to the interview and talking with us today.
Well, thank you. It's been a real pleasure talking.
My name is Eric LeMay, and you've been listening on the New Books Network to an interview with writer Dinty W. Moore, the editor of the Rose Metal Press Guide to Flash Nonfiction, Advice, and Essential Exercises from Respected Writers, Editors, and Teachers.